Uncanny Japan is author me, Teresa Matsura, exploring all that is weird from Japan. Strange superstitions and old wives' tales, cultural oddities and interesting language quirks. These are little treasures I dig up while doing research for my writing, and I want to share them with you here on Uncanny Japan. I hope you like the show. Hey, hey, everyone. I hope this podcast finds you and all your loved ones healthy and safe and staying as sane as possible in this upside-down world. Me, I'm doing okay. I'm really happy to say that this is my 50th episode of Uncanny Japan. I started the podcast on October 30th, 2016, so it's taken about 3.5 years to get here, and I'm really happy I'm here. And I'm happy you're here too. One of the reasons I started Uncanny Japan was because, given my circumstances, I thought I had a bit of a different perspective on Japanese culture, and I wanted to share that. But that wasn't the only reason. Doing this was also a way of me getting through a very difficult time in my life. As fate would have it, things got even more difficult before they got better. And they were just starting to get a lot better when, boom, now, here we have this heinous virus that is ravaging the world. The podcast has always been something I look forward to, a means of escape, kind of. And I really hope the shows can also help you put down the outside world for a few minutes as well. Since it's my 50th episode, I want to give a couple thank yous. First, I want to thank the guy who, without his help, this show would never have been or never be, Rich Pav. He's the one who lent me my first binaural mics and has stood by the sidelines and cheered me on, as well as been the master of everything sound and tech related. If you don't believe in miracles, just listen to the first episode that I did all by myself and compare it to now. Thank you, Rich, and I'm looking forward to our new venture, which I'm going to talk about in a few seconds. I also want to thank my patrons. They are all so wonderful, and they're the other reason I'm still doing this show, because without their support, I really couldn't afford to do this at all. I care for and appreciate every single one of them. Thank you, thank you. And finally, I want to thank you, my dear listeners, your messages, your emails, reviews, or just subscribing to the show. If I didn't think anyone was listening, I really wouldn't have lasted this long. So thank you. And another thing I want to do on this 50th episode is I want to announce some fun news that I'm really excited about. If you remember the past episode, 49, the cheesy one about finding an amabie on the beach, well, that was such a joy to make, and I started thinking about doing other things, kind of different stories, longer, more horror-related, and involving this old house I'm living in now. Rich Pav and I have spent entire days brainstorming and outlining and scripting a horror audio drama that we're going to start recording pretty soon. This is going to be so much fun. It'll be 11 episodes with patrons getting early access, bonus content, behind the scenes, bloopers, stuff like that. And it's going to be one of those grab your headphones and turn out the lights kind of show, so please look forward to that. Of course, Uncanny Japan will come out as usual twice a month, so no worries there. Anyway, I'll keep you updated here and let you know how it's going and when we'll be getting it up. Now for today's episode. I haven't done a story in a while, and I think I've only ever done one of my own stories here. It was way back in the beginning, I think episode like 7. I did a very short piece that I wrote about the Sennin body, the 1,000 stitched belt. But today I want to read a short story that's really dear to my heart. It's the first story I wrote after I decided I wanted to seriously do this writing thing. I had this idea to do a collection of stories, and I kind of wanted this story to be the keystone. It was probably written back in 1993 or 94 or something. It's also quite autobiographical. I'll go into more details there about what's made up and what's not over on Patreon. Anyway, another reason I really like this story is it's the one that got me my first book deal. I actually cold queried a publisher with this story, and I got a contract like a week later. And it's also the story that helped me woo my rocking agent. And it's the story my sound tech man, Rich Pav, who I just thanked earlier, read years and years and years ago when we knew each other only on Twitter. And he reached out to message me and tell me how much he really loved it. Also, there's a lot of yokai in it, so that's fun too. So anyway, it's got a lot of good memories attached to it, and in this chaotic time for my 50th episode, I think I want to share this with you. It's called Sand Walls, Paper Doors. Tally-ho, sang an unfamiliar voice. Enough time to realize it was indeed unfamiliar. And then crash. The explosion of shattering glass. Around midnight, Anne had finally fallen asleep to the erratic click-click shuffle of the mahjong tiles coming from the apartment next door. 1 hour later, when she bolted from her futon wide awake, it was to the sound of her window being smashed in. Anne's small, tatami-matted room had only one window. Sometimes, on steamy summer nights, if she accidentally fell asleep with it open, she could easily reach out and shut it without so much as sitting up. That's how close it was to where she slept. Anne watched, terrified, as a messy blonde mane poked through the gaping hole. The face looked around, eyes squinted, and then ducked back out. She could hear the slurred conversation that followed.
"Yo, man, I don't think this is your apartment."
"What?"
"Dude, there's some chick in there."
"One, two, three, shit. I'm number 5. There was the sound of scuffling, falling, and running away. Anne sat, trembling, as the cool breeze that smelled not unlike beer washed over her face. That was the night she promised herself she would move out of the international dorm. As it turned out, it wasn't as difficult as she thought it would be. A kind and observant professor had already noticed the dark circles under the girl's eyes, the way her grades no longer reflected the ambition she initially showed in class. After hearing her story, he introduced her to his eccentric sister, who had a 50-year-old house in her care. The place had not been lived in for quite some time and needed a lot of work. But if Anne was willing to weed the garden and wipe down the wooden floors now and again, the sister would let her rent it for no more than she paid for the dorm. There was no question about it. It didn't matter that the commute to and from the university would take an hour and a half, or that she'd be that far from any English speakers, any friends. In all honesty, Anne thought to herself, "I'm not here to speak English, and I don't really have any friends." The girl fell in love with the house on her first visit. 2 suitcases and 1 box of books later, and she was moved in. She spent an hour wandering from room to room, overwhelmed by the silence, breathing deep the sweet gold fragrance of tatami mats and something else. The smoky hint of camphor and sandalwood. Ghosts of incense burnt long ago. The narrow halls, low ceilings, and intricate lintels were all marbled hinoki wood. Anne brushed her fingertips against the walls. Each room was a different color. Ochre, olive, slate. But instead of being painted or wallpapered, they were covered in a thin layer of sand. The wall behind, hard as stone. No pictures could possibly be hung, Anne thought. That night, she slept better than she had in years. Snug in her futon, she dreamt of giggling Japanese children, tugging her pajama sleeves and begging her to play. When she woke, she noticed her pillow had made its way to her feet. Everything was just strange enough, just exciting enough, so that she didn't notice what was happening. At least not right away. First, she had to deal with living with the lack of house furniture. There was only one low kotatsu table where she sat cross-legged on the floor, ate her meals, and did her studies. Otherwise, there were no couches or chairs, no bookcases or wardrobes. Her futon had to be folded into threes and stowed away in the closet. On sunny days, she hung it outside and beat it with a bamboo racket. Deep baths were drawn and then topped with a wooden roll cover when not in use. The water was kept clean because she showered before soaking in the tub. Clothes were washed in small loads daily and hung in the sun to dry. Anne soon realized that despite being in the country for a year and a half, she didn't know Japan at all. What the girl loved most, though, was what she called in her journal the shimmering quiet. She wrote that sometimes, while reading or studying, it felt as if someone were silently observing her, a frequent sensation, near constant. She would not have been surprised to turn any corner, open any door, and find someone there. A lady kneeling with a large stretch of silk spread out over her lap, sewing tiny stitches with a crooked needle. Or a man who might be mending the bamboo skeletons of heavy paper umbrellas. Instead of making her jumpy and nervous, the feeling made her feel less alone. It wasn't long before she began to talk to these imaginary friends. She didn't think it strange at all, even when she started to name the one that felt most familiar. With spring came Anne's resignation to work in the overgrown garden behind the house. She spent days pulling smelly dokudami vines from the gravel, only to discover a trail of irregularly cut stepping stones, leading to a small pond that had been so strangled under years of overgrowth that it was practically invisible. She imagined lotus flowers blooming on the surface and bright orange and white koi swimming among the roots. The girl couldn't wait to fix it up. Occasionally, Anne would suddenly stop her gardening. She found that even outside, it was quite obvious that someone's eyes were studying her. This was also the first time she thought she heard voices. The day came when the garden had been meticulously pruned and swept. All the new flowers sunk into their earthy homes. It was also the day something even more curious happened. Something that opened the way for all the others. Anne decided she'd have lunch outside. She spread a blanket over the moss-dotted dirt and was nibbling a salmon-filled rice ball, a book resting on her knee, when she got a whiff of the most awful stench. The girl investigated, not sure what she was expecting to find. Perhaps a honey truck had driven by. But wasn't Thursday the day they cleaned the septic tanks? Upon further investigation, she found the smell coming from under the house. After retrieving a flashlight, she knelt near the metal grate that opened to the wide space under the house. A cat had probably climbed in there and died, she thought. The grate was twisted, almost torn completely off. The beam of light fell over stones and weeds, but no carcass. In the far corner, Anne caught two yellow-green eyes staring back at her. A cat that was sitting in what looked to be a giant nest made of sticks and coat hangers, the lids of discarded tuna cans and cigarette butts. Do Japanese cats build nests? She thought. Besides, it still didn't explain the odor. Here, kitty, 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 she called. Here, kitty, kitty. Just then, a small stone whacked her right between the eyes.
Ow, what the?
Anne stood up and felt her forehead for damage. She could have sworn she heard laughing as she hurried back inside the house to examine her injury.
What was that about?
She said to the presence she called Mimi, the one that was usually in the living room, but tended to follow her about the house, always a glance too far away. Out of habit, Anne cleaned when she was nervous. Throwing a cloth over her shoulder, she dragged a light-framed stool from the kitchen and set it up under the only object that ever gathered dust in the room. The kamidana, the god shelf, that hung high in the corner.
Kind of creepy if you ask me, she continued.
Her landlord had kept the kamidana decorated even while the house was empty. She impressed strongly on the girl to continue to do the same. To change the water daily, keep the rice, sake, and salt fresh. That is where the gods of the house reside, she was told. Whether or not Anne believed it didn't really matter much. She was getting a great deal on the house, and she had made the promise. Dusting each of the porcelain pieces, she set them back on the shelf.
I think I have a headache now.
The day after the gardening incident, Anne was still a little unsettled, but resumed her tidying up, only to discover a small, smooth stone laying on the kamidana next to a shallow bowl of rice.
What's this? She said, examining the rock.
She hadn't remembered it being there the day before. She shrugged to herself, plucked it off, and tossed it outside. The next day, there were two stones, stacked one on top of the other. This time, she changed the water, filled the sake cups to the brim, but didn't touch the rocks at all. On the third day, a third stone appeared. By the end of the week, the little rocks multiplied one by one until they formed a pyramid. When she thought they could get no higher, she rested a small plum blossom on the very top rock, only to laugh heartily the next day when she found an entire branch cleaved from her ume tree and propped up near the god shelf. All those clues. But she would never forget the first time she saw one. Daily, she woke up with a crick in her neck and her pillow at the foot of her futon. She tried changing pillows and using different, less slippery pillowcases, but nothing worked. Anne had never thought she was such a wild sleeper, but this went on nightly, without fail, until she got an idea. The idea was to safety pin the pillow to the thick mat. Now, however much she tossed and turned, it wouldn't budge. The girl fell asleep very proud of herself, thinking her problem solved. At first she fell into her usual dreams, children begging her to play. Tonight they were tossing around several cloth beanbags when she heard something behind her, a grunting sound. She imagined a pig or a boar. It was one of those sounds that starts buried in the dream but quickly wakes the sleeper in a frantic way when she realizes that the noise is actually coming not from her sleep, but from the room in which she's sleeping. When Anne opened her eyes, she froze. There, above her, knelt a real live monster. It was small and withered and had eyes like two of her porcelain teacups, bulging and rolled up to stare at the ceiling. Its enormous crack of a mouth kept pulling together in a concentrated knot and then stretching all the way back to its ragged ears again. Not yet noticing she was awake, it continued its fight with her securely fastened pillow. The girl squinted through her gray eyelashes and watched as its cheeks puffed out red and its stringy copper-colored hair tangled and flew with the effort. For some reason, though, she wasn't afraid. Instead, all she could think to herself was, "So I'm not crazy. They are real." "It's pinned," she said after some time, and then laughed as the creature, realizing she was no longer asleep, leapt straight up into the air and squealed like a baby pig. When it hit the ground, it darted into a shadowy corner where she could hear the knock-knock-knock of overgrown and greasy teeth. Or was it the imp's horribly knobby knees banging together? "It's okay, I won't hurt you," she said, sitting up in her futon. Anne named him Carl, because he so reminded her of her first best friend, a red-headed boy that was so terribly shy and suffered just as deeply from multiple cow licks. She spent a day in the library and found out that he was called a makuragaishi, a trickster who derives his pleasure from removing a person's pillow and placing it at their feet. She finally solved the problem by sleeping with no less than 6 pillows. A joker maybe, but Carl was kind. He'd misplace 2 or 3, but would always leave the rest for the girl to sleep with. On occasion, usually when she was dreaming that something in her refrigerator had spoiled, the girl would wake to see him curled up beside her. Carl looked frail, his ropey limbs all twisted in slumber, his mouth agape, his gusty snores vile. She would cover him with part of her blanket, turn over, and go back to sleep. That is when they began to trust her. For 2 years, she floated through the house. She cleaned, she studied, and she played. She was not lonely at all. Anne partook in games with the Zashkiwarashi, the ghostly children that came to her in her dreams. She fed scraps of food to the Oni children who lived in the nest under the house and snuck inside to cause all sorts of havoc. Sometimes it was as innocuous as piling rocks upon the Kamidana. Other times, she'd find the toes of all her shoes stuffed full with pickled plums, or wake to discover the garbage can was turned over because they were looking for used tea leaves or coffee grinds to rub through their hair. The girl wasn't surprised at all when one day, while she was cooking up some fried rice, a long Tenjo Sagari stretched down and plucked her apron strings untied. She shooed it with the dish rag and watched as it scuttled away, clicking nails across the wooden ceiling. She named him Stretch. Mimi turned out to be an Itamomen. When it did appear, it was simply a length of cloth that floated and flitted its way around the room. The quietest of all the creatures, it also offered the most comfort, as it always seemed to be watchful of her, worried about her. Anne imagined it understood she was a foreigner. She imagined it might be a little lonely itself. When the weather grew cold, the Itamomen would wrap around her waist and shoulders, keeping her warm. If it happened to be summer, Mimi would swoop under Anne's long hair and keep it off her sweaty neck. She adored it. It was the end of July when Anne got the phone call. She was repapering the shoji doors, a job she usually had to do twice a year due to the curious fingers constantly poking holes through the washi paper. The rainy season had started, which made it perfect weather. She lifted each partition off its track and leaned it against the fence in the garden, stirring the flour and water paste her landlord had taught her how to cook. She gazed out the window, watching the squares of paper pop under the warm raindrops. Soon the glue would loosen, and the shoji paper would all but melt away. Already the paste she was stirring was thickening. The phone rang. "Moshi moshi," Anne answered. "The emperor is coming." It was her professor's sister, her landlord. "Here?" "Next year. They want to extend the bypass," the lady paused. "Yes, here." They're going to extend the bypass? You mean the one that stops down the road from me? Yep, right over the house. The city is buying up all the land. And if I told you how much I was kidding for it, boy, you'd... What does that mean? Anne asked. You're going to have to move. And then, less excited, the landlord seemed to understand what this would mean to the girl. I'm sorry. They're only giving me 2 months to vacate the place. But I've talked to my brother, and he's found you a really nice, quiet apartment near the school. Anne was speechless. It's cheap and it's new, her landlord added. The girl was crushed. At first, there was a great welling of emotion around her. She was not sure if they knew or if they were just reacting to her sadness. But they were there, all of them. Anne could not talk, though. She could not bring herself to tell them what was going to happen. And as the days passed, they began to tuck themselves away one by one. By the time she was packing to move, she began to doubt if they were ever real at all. Maybe it was some sort of temporary insanity, maybe brought on by the atmosphere of the old place and the loneliness she was feeling. Maybe none of it had happened at all. She began looking for them. Under the house, the nest was deserted. No flighty rushes from the corner of her eye. And even when she slept with only a single pillow, it remained firmly in place. Maybe Anne thought she was just waking up. She had been living in the new apartment for 2 weeks. It had creamy wallpaper and high ceilings. There was carpet underfoot and furniture to sit on. The fluorescent lights were harsh blue and her room smelled new and like nothing at all. While the neighbors were quiet and friendly, they were very present. She felt always that her space was violated despite the fact that she was so achingly alone. Pinned to her wall was a calendar. There, the day after tomorrow, the large red X drawn through the square. The bus let her off in front of the old mom-and-pop vegetable stand that she used to go to daily. The vegetables were all gone, the shutters pulled down. Every house on the street was empty, making the neighborhood look even older than it did when she lived there. Anne took out the key from her purse. Her landlord had not even wanted it back. Said there was nothing of importance in the house anyway. Anne didn't get a chance to use it. When she arrived at her old house, she found the door had already been kicked in. All that was left was a crunchy layer of broken glass and a big hole, big enough for an adult to walk through. Setting her suitcase down in the foyer, she opened it. She removed one of the many hand towels, took off her shoes, and stepped up into the house. One last time, Anne walked through each room. She wiped the wood banisters as she passed, reached up to get the lintels. It hurt to see that the kamidana had fallen. She carefully righted the vases and ornaments, and as best as she could, swept the scattered rice and salt back into their respective bowls. The water and sake had long since evaporated. When she made her way to the living room, she was saddened to see the remnants of a teenage party or two. Teenagers can smell out these places. She could easily imagine them on their cell phones calling up friends, more friends. What a find. There were beer cans scattered about the floor and cigarette holes in the tatami mats. Someone had ripped holes into every square of the shoji, and some of the thin frames were splintered and broken. By the footprints, she could tell that whoever had done this hadn't even bothered to remove their shoes before entering the house. Anne sat and cried for a bit. There wasn't much left. She tried to talk to her old friends, pretending they were real again. She even listened hard for the flapping sound of Mimi, or the click-like walking of Stretch. Nothing. After an hour or so, she got up and returned to the foyer. She flipped closed the soft cover of a suitcase and began to zip it up. Seeing there was a towel hanging out, she tucked it back inside. Suddenly, she felt a tiny hand curl around her pinky. It squeezed slightly and let go. Anne smiled. "Everyone on board?" she asked, but there was no answer. The suitcase was easily twice as heavy on the way back to her apartment. She didn't mind. From the handle that pulled it along came the occasional vibration that she recognized as the playful giddiness of a dozen Oni children. On the bus, she laid the suitcase across her knees and felt its weighty warmth. She gently petted the top of the bag, identifying from the shiver or poke each of her friends inside. Anne could not wait to get home. The end. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. And I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Hey, do you like scary stories? Or maybe you don't do full-on horror, but enjoy a nice dark tale. Something creepy involving Japanese folklore and superstition? Well, if that's the case, you can sneak on over to Amazon or wherever you like to buy books and look for my 2 short story collections, A Robe of Feathers and The Carp-Faced Boy. All you need to do is search for Teresa Matsura. Let me spell that for you. Theresa Matsuura. Another place you can find me doing things is on Patreon. There, once a month, for my $5 and up patrons, I translate, retell, and record obscure Japanese folk tales. Some are dark, some are humorous, some are just weird. And lastly, another super sweet thing you can do is to write a review on iTunes. By doing this, you help like-minded people find Uncanny Japan. It's a little thing, but it means a lot. And it's a great big help. Thank you. I'm Teresa Matsura, and I'll talk to you soon.